and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are once again joined by Alicia from the Lorehounds. Hello, and thanks for making the trek back today.
it was real tough. I think I changed which legs were crossed since the last minute.
Glad to have you back. Yeah, we got to change posture every now and again. Yeah. Can't we just sit in one spot the whole time?
Otherwise, I'm going to just get some weird sciatic nerve shit going on. I'm not in my normal seat.
Yeah.
Normally, when we record, I have a very large couch in my living room, and you know, it's like a sectional, and Zach's on like one end, I'm on the other, and I've got like blankets and shit. So like sitting at this table is very different for us.
I like it because it gives lumbar support.
You have lumbar support.
I'm getting old, John. I need to be supported. Okay. Well, bodily functions aside, we are here to talk about some Dune. We are talking about minute 62 to 63 today, and we finally get to see or get to hear.
What did they give?
Yeah, exactly. What did Jessica's people give them? And we were all waiting with bated breath until this episode. So, drum roll, please. The answer is something to hope for.
That's not hope. Sorry.
Yeah. So she says this, and okay, so I was listening as I was taking my notes for this. I had my headphones on and I had the volume up a little bit loud because this was kind of a quiet talking scene, and this scared the shit out of me because I forgot that it was coming. And so when Paul, in his surprising bout of rage, he shouts, "That's not hope." Just 0 to 100, no warning, all gas, no brakes. And it does not bother Jessica one bit.
It's so loud that it echoes across the desert. Yeah. Like, so I've talked about on many episodes, I've talked about like going back 5 seconds and like re-listening to sections. And yeah, you definitely, like, if you listen closely, you can hear it like reverberating off of the dunes and echoing across the desert and everything. Sound design for that line, fantastic. Love it. 10 out of 10. This scene also kind of exhibits one of my favorite movie tropes, and we're going to get into another part in this minute of my favorite movie trope of whispers and explosions, where movies are like EQ'd for one, but then the other is just like way completely out of whack. In this case, the explosion was way completely out of whack.
Yeah.
I remember... So Zach and I got to go see Dune Part 2 a little early at the special fan event and everything that was being done here in the U.S. We got to see it about a month early, and we saw it in an IMAX theater. So having IMAX sound for that scene, I remember, made me just like jump out of my chair a little bit. And I was like, oh, shit, I was not expecting that at all. So it was a good moment.
Yeah.
When we went to go see it, so.
But like I said, Jessica she doesn't give a shit about this. She's unbothered, and I aspire to this level.
Unbothered in her own element.
Yeah, I aspire to be this unbothered in life one day. And she just kind of like, she's just looking around.
I mean,
letting Paul get his stuff out.
If parents of teenagers probably learn to expect that. It's like,
very,
okay.
Very true.
Like, yeah, sure. Do you want some lunch?
That makes sense. I don't have any children myself, but I do have 5 nephews all under the age of 10. And I get it. I get it. And I see that coming from their parents as well. So.
I just have 2 cats.
Sometimes my cats yell at me too, okay?
My cat yells at me constantly. Daily. It's his favorite thing to do.
Pokes me in the face if that doesn't get my attention.
So Paul, like, he composes himself again. He just shakes his head and kind of rolls his eyes a little bit. And they're interrupted by one of the Fremen who's down in the valley that they're looking over. Fremen shouts up to them and says, "Reverend Mother, we have to go. Reverend Mother, we have to go." the camera kind of pans up over the desert, and we start to hear some ominous music swelling in the background. Paul does not really enjoy this interruption, so he just kind of like scoffs, and Jessica turns towards him and says, "I'll be waiting for you," with a smile.
It's more of a smirk.
Yeah, okay, well, she smiles. She said, "I'll be waiting for you." And then shit gets a little weird.
Just a little bit.
Like, this conversation was already strange. Because there's a third party that we haven't seen, but we've heard.
Well, no, we've seen.
Oh, sorry. That's yes, true. Sorry. We have seen them. We have seen her.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jessica is passing along messages from her unborn child. So that's an odd thing to do in a conversation. But now we get this really funky voice distortion. And she says, "All of us." Now, who do you think the "all of us" is referring to?
I mean, it's the latent memories of all the Reverend Mothers before.
But this is the question is, does, I mean, we had a lot of discussion about this with Doom Prophecy. Do the same rules apply? And what are the rules? Like, we know what the rules are in the books, but what are the rules in this universe? What is,
I don't know. I think they are still figuring this out. I think the people who are making the movies and the shows, they're still figuring it out. Because there's not been a lot of consistency in that regard.
Yeah.
I feel like Villeneuve was going with the book version, because why wouldn't he? And then Dune Prophecy just wasn't keeping that in mind or something, or misunderstood someone. Or
Dune Prophecy said all of your maternal memory, not just the Reverend Mothers.
But it's also, it's more than that too, because also we have cases of people remembering past their death, and it seems like it's more than just memory in Doom Prophecy. And
oh yeah. I forgot. Sorry. I blacked all that shit out. I'm going to be honest with you. I remember in our post Doom Prophecy, episode that we did together with you and David, like we had all those conversations of like, what the fuck was this? And that wasn't a fan of all of that. But yeah, that was certainly something. I will say, bringing up prophecy and everything, they were consistent with whatever vocal effects they did for that weird "all of us" also being used in prophecy.
Sure.
So I can't knock them for that part of the consistency. But yeah, like who and what I'm going off of what has been said in the movie, which was the memory of all Reverend Mothers that came before.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll agree with that. It's just a very odd way to say it. And it's phrased in a weird way. She says, "I'll be waiting for you, all of us."
It is interesting. I can't remember if it's before or after this in the movie where Jessica, oh no, it's after this because Paul hasn't taken the water of life yet. Sorry, spoilers. But then Jessica, okay, so in the book version, Paul and Jessica have this conversation about the fact that they're actually Harkonnens, what happens basically at the beginning of this movie when they're in a tent, or maybe that was the end of the last movie, rather.
Mm-hmm.
But in the movie, she says she only learned it once she took the water of life. So I guess the prevailing theory is that, what's her name? I want to say Rohirrim. That's a Lord of the Rings thing.
that is very different.
You're mixing your universes.
Moheim. Do you think that she is her mother? In which case it fits because, she's has a memory of a Reverend Mother, but that is not the Reverend Mother who, what does Denis Villeneuve know the rules either?
I think they're going to follow that thread of Moheim is Jessica's mother.
Mm-hmm.
If they ever do anything on screen with it, this being a story centered around the Bene Gesserit, I could see that being something they do in the third movie because Moheim has a much bigger part in Prophecy than she does in the latter half. Messiah. Excuse
but
me.
is she getting the memories of the line of her female, mothers, grandmothers, etc., or is it of, the Reverend Mother who gave her basically her memories in that ceremony that we saw, or is it both?
Yeah, that's... So in the books, we get flashes of Romalo's life as Jessica's going through the ordeal, the agony, excuse me. Mm. So we see like a young Romalo and we see her life. And then, yeah, I'm trying to remember. It's like she sees it depicted as like endless hallways and there are reverend mothers standing there. So I want to say in the books it is Reverend Mother, like the line of Reverend Mothers before them.
Isn't it?
But that wouldn't make sense if it's a genetic memory.
Right.
It's described as a genetic memory, so it should be the mothers.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether they went through the agony or not.
So did Frank Herbert create this problem? No, I think later on at least. it gets a little looser and deeper what memories they have.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. So I'm going to toss that to the listening audience. If you have a suggestion or a theory or something or answer to this question, please let us know, because this would be a good one to bring in the community of nerds around.
Call upon the Synod. I didn't think about the inconsistencies of prophecy because I try not to think about prophecy too much. But you do bring up a good point with how like prophecy also looks at memory after death, but before that current moment and all that weirdness. So I don't know.
It should be the memory stops when the mother has a baby.
Or point of conception, I think is the,
I think birth.
The,
at least,
was it birth? Okay.
At least in the Brian Herbert books, which is what I've read most recently, other than the original dude. Yeah.
John, calm down, John. Calm down. It's fine.
The good books.
Okay, go.
I do like the books, actually.
I'm half and half.
Anyways, moving on. No, I was going to say, though, like I also am very much in the Moheim is Jessica's mother camp with all of this, because there's just a lot that adds up in the book to make it make sense. But I also think the encyclopedia goes a little deeper into it.
It does, but
there's also the understanding, though, that the encyclopedia is essentially fan fiction that has Frank's, you know, blessing. So it's not like
it's not
true
canon,
but it's as good of an explanation as we can get without getting into all of Brian's weirdness.
It's not any weirder than the other stuff. It's based on the same materials.
Sure. Well, it's based on the notes that Frank left behind. Here's a picture of a CD that says Dune Notes.
All right. I'm going to break this one up. I'd love to knock heads with some other Dune folks about this question, because that's a good question.
Yeah. But yeah, Paul's just kind of beside himself as he watches Jessica walk her way down the dune. It almost looks like she's slithering down the dune a little bit because of just how long her, you know, Reverend Mother garb is and everything.
Or is it the pregnancy or sand walking influence? Or is just like sand is hard to walk through?
I have never been pregnant, so I can't talk about what walking while very pregnant is like.
They've also been very inconsistent on the ease at which sand is walked upon.
Yeah.
Sometimes it is so easy you can run up a dune like nothing.
Sometimes it's like walking on pavement. Other times it's like walking on sand.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's more compacted. But I just have to say, I like, though, before we step away from their conversation, I like the way they filmed versus this is a film with a lot of wide shots. And that's one of the lovely things about it. But this conversation in particular, the camera stays very close to, you know, keeping them in a constant bust view, you know, shoulders up. So it's a literal tete-a-tete in the shadows.
Yeah. That's true.
It makes it feel a bit more claustrophobic in the conversation, and a little, a little more intense and
intimate, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Intimate, but also intense, because they are like verbally sparring with each other a little bit.
Yeah.
Between Paul and Alia and Paul and Jessica.
Yeah.
So, I think it adds a little bit to the tension of like, why aren't you leaning into this, you know, whole Kwisatz Haderach thing and this whole Messiah thing.
Right.
But yeah, no, we've talked a lot about the cinematography of this movie, and all of the shots have been so just like beautifully orchestrated, from the actual like mechanical components of shooting everything. This was one that, another scene that really helps with that. And then like with the wider shot of Jessica leaving, kind of breaks that intensity a little bit in that moment. But yeah, we get Jessica kind of walking, slithering, pregnant walking down the dune. And then we get a little more rise to that music. And we cut back very briefly to the vision that Paul was telling Chani about just a few minutes ago, how he had this dream of following someone to the south. And we very clearly see that it is Jessica that he's following to the south. And in doing so, this will lead to
the death and dying that's happening all around her.
The death and dying of billions.
Yeah.
So, he knows it's coming, and, I don't think there's anything that he can do to stop it per se. Slow it. Yes.
Yeah. And this is something that we've talked about before, but Paul's prescience has not been given a lot of spotlight in this movie. It's something that happens occasionally, and it's more used as like a plot device just to further the movie along. But it is not really explored to any great depth. So I don't think he understands like the things aren't always set in stone. He understands it because he said it to Moheim during the Gom Jabbar. He's like, when she said things always happen as you dream them, and he says not exactly. So he understands that there's a little bit of a difference, but I think he is, he's seeing these visions and he's like, well, that's the way it's going to be. Whereas Book Paul around here is very wary of his visions. He's like, well, this one didn't happen the way that it was. Like he has a deeper understanding, a more intimate understanding with how they operate. Doesn't fully understand them, I don't think, at this point, but he at least knows more about them.
Yeah.
Hmm. I have a question. Do you think that the vision was supposed to be a reveal that it was Jessica? Because it always seemed obvious to me from the beginning, but they do this sun glare thing where it's like, oh, it's her. Well, duh.
Yeah. I think it was obvious because I know what Rebecca Ferguson looks like. From the first time we saw this vision, I knew it was Jessica.
It's also just like, if they wanted it to be ambiguous about whether it was Chani or Jessica that Paul was following south, like Rebecca Ferguson and Zendaya have two very different hairstyles, and like the hair is one of the things that you could very clearly see in the first instance of this vision. Mm-hmm. And it was very clearly Jessica's hair. Right. Like there's just no like other way of describing it. So like I think this was more of a putting this scene in the movie to show people that maybe aren't watching it super closely or don't fully understand like everything, like, oh, he just talked about following this person to the south and then it's going to lead to a lot of death and destruction, and that person is his mother. So like, as much as I don't want to say it's for the normies, I feel like it's just a shot for the normies.
That's fair.
This movie is typically really good about showing, not telling. And this is kind of the bad instance of showing.
Well,
showing and telling, I guess.
It's just like, you see, you get it, you get it.
we're all
on the same page. Good. Next,
it's Rebecca Ferguson, yeah. And then the caption pops up under her face: Rebecca Ferguson with an arrow. Yeah.
Exactly.
You get it. Cool. Worm time, baby.
Wait, one more question though before we go to worm time. With this whole idea of like Paul worrying he's not what's best for the Fremen, I get it, because he has these visions of them all starving because they're following him to, well, it's called jihad in the books, but they're afraid to say that in the movies and TV show.
We always refer to it as jihad, mm-hmm. because it's what it is.
Yeah. But what would be better, given the Fremen are in this situation, and if the Atreides weren't there, it would just be like them fighting against the Harkonnens. What does Paul think would be the best for them? To collaborate with the Harkonnens? Because the Harkonnens would never look in the south because they're apparently too lazy to go through the storms? What would be the best if they weren't there?
I think they're stuck in an endless cycle of guerrilla warfare.
Mm.
If Paul doesn't head south, which... I mean, I feel like there's no...
things wouldn't change. So I don't think the status quo would not change if Paul wasn't there. Stilgar would continuously be looking for his signs for the Lisan al-Ghaib. He would be looking for the, just to fill this prophecy. And maybe something would come around later. But, I think that they would reach that same equilibrium. And I'm using that word very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
That they had been in for the last 80 or so years.
You mean to tell me that there's no change in the universe of Dune? And that things are stagnant?
Feudal system, blah blah blah. 10,000 years.
What? Yeah. Stagnation in Dune? No.
Yeah, I think it would have just gone to exactly how it was before. Maybe worse for the Fremen, because they, they're I guess more of a pressure now to hunt and kill them. So probably worse. They would probably end up worse.
Yeah. Sorry about it.
But that's like, you guys watched Andor, right? Like, bad luck, Fremen.
I'm halfway through season 2.
Oh, okay.
I have only watched season 1.
All right.
And that's mostly just because I've had other things going on.
Okay.
John got a little Star Wars'd out for a little while there.
I just got Disney'd out, if I'm going to be honest with you. Like, Endgame happened, and then Spider-Man immediately after Endgame, and that was cool. And then I was like, I'm good for a while. I'll come back to this eventually. And eventually has not happened.
Hmm. All right.
But Andor season 2 is on my list. I wanted to wait until it was like all completely out and everything, because I don't like waiting for next episodes of shows.
I don't know if this is a show that you want to binge watch, though. I mean, they force us to binge watch 3 a week, and that was already a lot, because this is some heavy real world shit.
Yeah, but I think
they're talking about current political like shit on this one.
Sure, but awesome. also you understand my ability to binge watch shit and like fucking just absorb information.
That
said, I mean, it's
the information I'm currently like keeping in my head is all Dune stuff, so I don't like get too off of the Dune Minute.
But it's not
wagon.
It's not about absorbing information. It's about like the heaviness of it, like the genocide of it all. Anyway, from one genocide to another.
Human history. It sucks.
So,
worm time.
We get one more quick little glimpse at Paul looking distressed as Jessica's walking away.
It's his turn now.
Yes. And then we get to cut to this aerial tracking shots of the worm moving very, very quickly through the desert. Now, I want to pause our conversation here because I got a beef to get out.
Mm-hmm. Beeves?
I got some beeves.
Oh.
Don't be a coward. Show us getting that thing on
the Thank worm. You.
Come on. I wanted to see. How do they get it on the worm?
What are the mechanics of getting the palanquin on the worm? Because we just watched Paul barely get his ass on a worm. Granted, the worm that Paul called was probably much larger than this one.
Maybe.
And also, it was his first time riding a worm, not an entire group of Fremen who have been doing this since they were 12.
Right.
So I'm sure it's a bit more graceful.
Can I read the last thing in my notes for this episode? Word for yes, word says, for traveling by worm. Hope in part three they show a dismount to shut people up, LOL.
No, I think dismounting is easier than getting on it. I think so you ride, they say the trip to the south is a 20 thumper trip. They say that in the books, I believe. I don't think it's called out in the movie. But it's a
20, no, it is not called out in the movie.
It's a 20 thumper trip to the south. So clearly they have to switch worms at least 20 times. So they ride the worm until it's tired and it slows down, and they take their hooks out and it slowly starts to go underneath. And as it goes underneath, they hop off. Getting off is I feel like the easy part if the worm's tired.
I mean, it's so big. They just need to get the first ones on to hook in so that the worm doesn't dive. And then they have like four people with the palanquin, or however we've decided that's pronounced. And they just like hop on together, you know?
Okay. It's a lot of coordination, though, and I want to see it. I want to see that on screen.
All right. I hope they invest in that.
Yeah. Well, boy, do I have some fun facts for you. But let's finish talking about the movie before we get into my fun facts from Mars. So yeah, we have this huge aerial shot of the worm just approaching the desert, or the storm belt of Arrakis, which crosses its equator. And then we cut to a on-level view of what's going on in the worm. And I don't know if you guys noticed this when you were watching, but the worm rider that we have here, it's wearing a very particular like helmet and set of armor and everything.
I took special note of this. Yes.
Artan Sol doesn't have a lot about the design of the armor. It just shows some of the up close and some of the concepts around getting to this final one. But it's very, very reminiscent to me of indigenous people in the U.S. And I don't know if this is a thing in Scandinavian countries as well, but indigenous people in the U.S. would get like whale bones and then cut out very small slits in them so that they can see and not just get their eyes completely obliterated, A, by the snowstorms, but B, by the sun reflecting off of the snow as well. So that was like, I saw that and I was like, that's I know where they sourced that from and everything. And then obviously the armor is there because you're riding on top of this worm and
through the storm,
as we saw in part one, rocks and shit are getting knocked all over the place. So you need to be protected in one way or another. So I thought it was really cool to see the storm crossing armor on the rider.
It was interesting that no one else had that suit on, though. I know that whoever's at the front is going like, they have to be there. They have to be standing to steer. I understand that.
Yeah.
But there's not like a lower decks that the other people can go.
Did they have blankets at least or something? Did they all like hutter it?
Well, they did have some blankets, and they also had a bunch of backpacks and stuff that were very padded. And Artan Sol calls these backpacks out as well because their initial inspiration for those was, you know, turtle shells with the way that the backpacks were built and how they were padded and everything. There's obviously torso protection and everything. Limbs, things can happen to limbs, I guess. And as we'll find out, you know, people get hit in the face with rocks all the time.
Right.
I think the armor for the rider is more important because you need to ensure that the rider maintains the hooks at all times. Yep. So, but we see this group huddled around the palanquins, and our last 2 seconds of the minute are of a Fremen man, you know, getting up and, you know, beginning to maneuver his way towards Jessica's palanquin. We do get some shots, you know, zooming in as well before the end of the minute of Jessica sitting inside the palanquin. And since we're here, I want to talk about what Artan Sol has to say about it. Took about 6 iterations to get the look and feel right. One of the things that Denis Villeneuve wanted was something that would be made out of natural materials that the Fremen could easily gather, which is why it has that very like basket looking appearance. A lot of natural fibers used to make it, but it was also made of those light natural materials because of the whole mounting and dismounting the palanquin on top of Shai Hulud thing.
Gotcha.
If you think about palanquins that you've seen in other TV media and other movies, the people that are carrying them are standing either on front or in back of the actual box itself. But in this, the arms that are holding the palanquin have the people carrying off on the side. Mm-hmm. And I think that was deliberately done in order to ease with the mounting and the dismounting, mm-hmm. to your point, Alicia, about the dismounting, mm-hmm. and everything. Mm. To ease with kind of rolling the palanquin on and off of Shai Hulud.
Gotcha.
As okay. they're getting it, you know, up on the worm. So logically that kind of makes sense. And then obviously the shape was designed for aerodynamics of worm riding and everything as well. There, a note from the book was that there was no space for luxury. It was as purpose-built as possible. And set decorator Shane Viau was referred to in Art and Soul about all of the design and history of the palanquin. Sorry if I butchered your last name, Shane. It's V-I-A-E-U.
Viau.
V-I-E-A-U. Sorry.
V-I-E-A-U.
Beats me.
My last name is French, but it's not that French.
I likened it to like a seed pod. It looked like a...
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Fremen love to take cues from nature. Mm-hmm. So if the... Yeah, just it looked like a little seed to me.
It's a basket web seed pod.
Weaved?
Weaved.
Is that a word? Woven.
Is a basket... Shut up. It's a basket woven seed pod. God.
It's, yeah, weaved by sulk weirms.
Yes.
Weaved by weirm.
the person driving, steering, controlling, whatever
you want to call it.
I really enjoyed seeing that getup, like the padded suit. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool. It makes total sense. It's a utilitarian design. But it reminded me of a couple of like other sci-fi properties, like things from them. And I just have to wonder if they took cues from these. So the first one was, the police in Fifth Element.
Yep.
It really looks like the whole getup that they wear. Mm-hmm. And then this is a kind of a brief thing, but in the pilot of Star Trek Enterprise, Next Generation, Q comes down and he's doing his whole Q thing around, and he starts to go through costumes of various points in human history, and there's one point where he's saying how humans. Learn to control their military with drugs, and the military outfit that he dons at that point looks strikingly similar to this. Mm. But it's only on screen for like 10 seconds. You know, it's very, very brief, but I had to go look it up and I was like, wow, it's just like a full padded bodysuit.
Someone in the helmet. Someone in the art and costume department was a big Star Trek fan.
Maybe.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. That's right. And then the real life example was like a full catcher's outfit, baseball catcher's suit.
Kind of. Yeah. But yeah, no, thinking back to other properties, the helmet kind of reminds me of a more aerodynamic helmet from the Spacing Guild from the sci-fi miniseries. They had that same like big pointy rounded helmet, but it wasn't as like sleek.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It was also made of blue velvet.
Ooh, they're classy at the Guild.
The Guild has a lot of money.
I mean...
As we have found out with our episode with Chome Director. Yeah. But yeah, that's all the notes that I have from Art and Soul about the palanquin. However we're going to pronounce it. Who knows?
We'll say it 10 more ways.
Aaliyah. No.
Let's just piss everyone off. Rabin.
All right, cool.
Well, that's all the notes I had. Anything else from y'all before we dive into the next minute?
Nothing else from me.
No, I think that's it from me.
Alrighty, well, you can find the Dune Minute online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. In the description, we will also have all of Alicia's and the Lorehounds projects available for you to check out as well. Strongly recommend you go check those out. They do so much more content than we can even imagine doing. So they're always an ever running cycle of shows over there.
Since I already mentioned the Dune stuff, on the Lorehounds feed, we are currently covering Murderbot. So if you want some lighter, fun sci-fi fare, John and I are having a good time with that. The other John.
Yeah, the John Lorehound and John from Dune Minute. I'm sure it doesn't get confusing at all.
Especially since we also have a Jean. That's,
Oh, perfect. Even better. Alrighty. Well, we'll be back tomorrow with another episode of the Dune Minute podcast. We'll see you then.
See ya.